This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
The Orange Show is celebrating our 25th anniversary with Car Wars.
This free display of amazing vehicles on Saturday, September 16, 2006, from 1 to 6 p.m., occurs at 2401 Munger Street.
Houston's top lowrider clubs,
design shops,
and art car artists
will fill our field full of four-wheeled beauties
with intricately detailed mural-covered hoods,
supercharged hydraulic systems, rocketing cars off the ground,
and vehicles decorated beyond belief,
and compete for a prize package that includes premium placement in the 2007 Art Car Parade,
awarded by the popular vote from all the folks that attend Car Wars. The whole day is packaged with excitement, including the finals of the Urban Street Dance Competition, live music, a shoe decorating workshop, and tours of the world-famous Orange Show. Check out orangeshow.org for more information about the 25th anniversary celebration featuring Car Wars.
KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, I'm Jack Walensky.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
J.D. Doyle.
Deborah Bell.
And on tonight's show, we'll be discussing the impact of the events of September 11, 2001 on the queer community with the Empire Pride Communications Director, Joe Tarver, who played key roles in the Pride's agenda's groundbreaking work with gay and lesbian survivors of the terrorist attacks. Also, continuing coverage in memory of the fifth anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, the Queer Voices will talk about their thoughts about the day and honor some of the queer heroes of the day. We'll be updating you on news from the Community Center with Tim Brookover, including upcoming Queer Bingo with Jennifer Renee and J.D. Doyle. Joan Devlin talks with Service Members International about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the impact during these times of continuing war and so-called war on terror. Plus, This Way Out, music calendar, community news, and much, much more. And are we ready for This Way Out? Let's go right to our news wrap.
I'm Charles Hall.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 9th, 2006. There are new developments and stories out of both Uganda and Ghana that we reported on in recent weeks. Human Rights Watch and the International Lesbian and Gay Association have joined local activists in Uganda to condemn a tabloid newspaper's publication of the names of several men whom the paper said are gay. The banner headlined story has queer advocates fearing a government crackdown in the country where sodomy is punishable by life in prison. Human Rights Watch researcher Jessica Stern said in a statement this week that President Yoweri Museveni's government routinely threatens and vilifies lesbians and gays and subjects sexual rights activists to harassment. At a moment when sensational publicity has spread fear among a whole community, she continued, the authorities must exercise their responsibility to protect, not persecute. The list was published last month in the tabloid newspaper Red Pepper, which claimed it needed to expose how the terrible vice known as sodomy is eating up our society. It also published details of venues popular with gays and lesbians and has said it might publish a list of suspected lesbians.
The 45 men listed by the newspaper last month included army officers, priests, university lecturers, entertainers, bankers, students, and lawyers. At least five of them were arrested after publication of the list, and more have reportedly gone into hiding. A regional newspaper this week published the name and photo of one man. It said the police are hunting in what it called a crackdown on gays who are reportedly on the verge of overthrowing the straight sex generation. It also urged public cooperation to nab him before he pollutes the population. The newspaper said the man's lover had already been arrested. Sexual Minorities Uganda has defiantly circulated a letter of protest to the country's media, saying it was making a loud call to everyone who believes in the rights of human beings to stand up and protest along with us to put an end to such injustices against LGBTI and other marginalized people in Uganda. Attacks on political freedoms in the country, which is rife with economic problems and internal conflicts, have included the arrest and beating of opposition members of parliament.
The president of the Gay and Lesbian Association of Ghana said this week that the media made up stories of an international LGBT conference that was supposedly to be held this month in Accra. Patrick McDonald told the Crusading Guide newspaper that his members were unaware of any such conference and that the media had fueled public hatred toward lesbians and gays by fabricating the story. The speculation began last week when the Interior Minister announced that the government was going to ban the conference. His remarks were welcomed by many leading Christian and Muslim clergy in Ghana, some of whom had apparently contacted government officials to complain about the conference.
Lawmakers in Latvia this week rejected a bill that sought to ban homosexual propaganda in the mass media. The populist Latvia First Party had prepared draft amendments to laws that govern the nation's media. The measures would have made it illegal to publish supportive articles about gays and lesbians or interviews with them in which they talk about their lives or civil rights. The changes were necessary, the party said in a statement, to ensure that the mass media do not weaken the role of the family institution, do not split society, and do not create a misconception about a group of individuals claiming special treatment due to their beliefs. Many pundits said the proposed amendments contravened Latvian and international law, and speculated that Latvia First was trying to tap into homophobia in the Baltic state ahead of next month's general election. Latvia First currently has 13 seats in the 100-member parliament, and a party member is the coalition government's interior minister. In July, he persuaded the Riga City Council to ban what would have been the country's second pride parade, citing alleged threats to security. Latvian gay men, lesbians, and their supporters, along with activists from Europe and North America, staged alternative pride events, including an LGBT religious service and meetings at a hotel. People coming and going from the events, including clergy who conducted the religious service, were confronted by Christian fundamentalists, ultranationalists, and neo-Nazis, some of whom threw eggs, rotten food, and human feces at them. Seven of the attackers have thus far been fined the equivalent of about $65 for petty hooliganism. Linda Frymane, a spokesperson for the pride organizing group Mosaica, called the punishments inadequate, saying the assaults were an incitement to hatred, and that the attacker should have been charged with criminal hooliganism. Latvia's general prosecutor agrees and is attempting to have the decisions annulled and the attackers retried under criminal statutes.
But the LGBT rainbow flag will be proudly flying over Taipei's City Hall on September 17th in what officials call a first for any Asian city, according to a report this week in the Taipei Times. The landmark event will be part of an annual festival called LGBT Civil Rights Movement Queer Friendly Taipei, which has been hosted since 2000 by the city's Department of Civil Affairs with an annual budget of about $30,000. Wang Ping of Taiwan's Gender Sexuality Rights Association, which is helping to organize the festival, told the Times that the flag raising will be followed by lesbi-gay rights forums that afternoon in the city council chamber and an art exhibition later in the month. A pride parade is planned for September 30th, along with a mass same-gender wedding ceremony to push for legal marriage equality.
Canada's Bloc Québécois has vowed to stand united against Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper's plan for parliamentary review of the 2005 vote that legalized same-gender marriage in the country. All of the party's 51 members in the 308-member House of Commons will be expected to vote in favor of marriage equality in any reconsideration of the matter. The 29 members of the New Democratic Party are planning to do the same. The Defend Marriage Coalition, an alliance of 13 so-called traditional marriage, family, and religious groups, announced this week that they'll be investing tens of thousands of dollars for public campaigning and to lobby MPs to support reconsideration of the issue. Harper promised during his successful campaign earlier this year that if the House adopts a resolution to reopen the debate, the government will introduce legislation to restore the traditional definition of marriage while respecting existing same-sex marriages. Recent polling has found that 62% of Canadians oppose any attempt to take away gay and lesbian couples' access to marriage.
Meanwhile, a pernicious Conservative Party MP's private member's bill in what may be Canada's most conservative province, Alberta, has been rejected. The measure, which would have forbidden anyone from being prosecuted for speaking out on or acting on their beliefs against marriage equality, died for a second time last week in the provincial parliament. Bill 208 would also have put limits on discussion of the subject in schools. Opponents said the bill attempted to enshrine in law the dehumanization of gays and lesbians. They said it would have given employers carte blanche to fire gay or lesbian employees and landlords to evict lesbian and gay tenants simply because of their sexual orientation. Both the province's Liberals and New Democrats condemned the bill as an affront to the rights and dignity of lesbi-gay Albertans.
But in what's being called an unprecedented move, top-level British professional soccer team Manchester City Football Club has paid four figures to join the Diversity Champions program of the leading national queer advocacy group Stonewall, according to a report in the Observer newspaper. The action commits the team to recruit gays and lesbians to work at the stadium, reach out to lesbi-gay fans, and to ban homophobic language. A statement issued by Alastair McIntosh, the club's chief executive, said, "We want to send a welcoming message to gay, lesbian, and bisexual supporters. Be inclusive and be a progressive employer." According to The Observer, which said McIntosh's sister is an open lesbian, the move could lead to a dramatic change of attitude in the macho world of football, which is regarded as one of the last bastions of homophobia.
And finally, speaking of open lesbians, Ellen DeGeneres will be hosting the 79th Annual Academy Awards telecast on February 25th, producer Laura Ziskin told reporters this week. "There is no more challenging hosting job in show business. It requires someone who can keep the show alive and fresh and moving, as well as someone who is a flat-out great entertainer." DeGeneres has twice hosted the Primetime Emmy Awards telecast, co-hosted it in 1994, and has won a slew of those trophies for her popular weekday TV talk show. It will be her first time as host of the Oscars telecast. "When Laura Ziskin called, I was thrilled," DeGeneres said. "There's two things I've always wanted to do in my life. One is to host the Oscars. The second is to get a call from Laura Ziskin." You can imagine that day's diary entry.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 9th, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Charles Hall.
And I'm Rick Watts. This is Queer Voices.
And this is JD, and I love the internet. At 6:30 this evening, I got an email from an artist friend of mine, Jay Spears, sending me a sneak preview of the title track from his brand new album. We get to play it now. It's called Playing on My Team.
and on Tico. Ah, here's the man for me. Did it really come as a surprise? Chico likes guys who are super, super size. So yeah, we're pals, but it's not what I thought it would be. Just 'cause you're playing on my team doesn't mean you're playing with me. Just 'cause you're playing on my team doesn't mean you're playing with me.
Is Queer Voices.
This is Deborah Bell, and of course, today, in memory of the fifth anniversary of the events of September 11th, 2001, we're doing a little bit of special programming, as most of the media has been doing today, but very few of them have covered the issues that affected the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. It is a day that all of us remember where we were and what we were doing when we heard the news, just like when Kennedy was shot, when Elvis died, when the Challenger blew up. And many of us were affected in one way or another through family or friends or because of the company we worked for or in various ways. Myself having a son who was 20 blocks away from the World Trade Center. There's a lot of people who were not recognized in their loss, we have with us Ellie Shaliba is going to interview Joe Tarver, who is the communications director of Empire Pride, and he has done a lot of work with the survivors, the GLBT survivors of the events of September 11th. So, Ellie?
Yes. Joe, are you there?
I'm there. Or I'm here.
All right, we're getting this right. Joe Tarver, correct?
Yes, I'm the communications director of Empire State Pride Agenda. We're New York's statewide LGBT civil rights organization.
All right, and since September 11th, first off, would you like to start with your own 9/11 or September 11th story?
Well, you know, September 11th is always a difficult day for it's a difficult day for the nation, certainly, and it's a difficult day for those of us who live here in New York City. I was on the train going to work, actually, when I heard that a second plane had gone into one of the other towers, and it was at that point that I thought, this is, something's not right here. And when the subway stopped at West 23rd Street, we didn't go any further. And the conductor kept repeating, due to problems at the World Trade Center, we're temporarily here at the station. Please stand by. The train I was on went down to the World Trade Center, and it was at that point I decided to get off, and I walked to work, and our offices were in the West Village at that time, and when I got down to West 14th Street, I could look down further downtown, and I could see the World Trade Center, and it was a shocking sight to see the smoke billowing out of the two towers. And as the morning wore on, I got to my office, and actually I watched the first tower go down, and Everyone was at trucks, cars, everything was at a standstill, and people were out in the streets just watching, and it was incredibly silent. When the towers went down, obviously, it wasn't silent. We were in such shock. People, obviously, it was something we didn't expect. I went in the office to try to make some phone calls to tell people I was all right. And it was it was impossible to make phone calls, but I was able to email some of my good friends around the city and some that actually worked down there, and we were able to correspond by email to, assure ourselves that we were still here. It was, a day that I'll never forget, and it was about an hour and a half later when people began showing up in the village who were walking out of downtown in their business suits and carrying their shoes, that we gave them water and let them use the restrooms and make phone calls if the phones would work. And it's a day I'll never forget.
All right. And since then, several survivors funds were set up, including the federal one. And unfortunately, at the very beginning, domestic partners weren't covered. Could you tell us about that?
Well, it became apparent when it really became known that thousands had died. Our executive director at that point was Matt Foreman, who's now the executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and he and I had a conversation about it, and we both agreed that a large number of people that had perished, a great number of them would be lesbian, gay, bi, and trans, and that we were wondering how their survivors were going to do. How would our families be recognized? And we really didn't have an answer to that. And I got on the phone and called some of the relief agencies that were beginning, relief funds that were beginning to organize themselves, the largest ones, and we wanted, and my question to them was, what will be your definition of family? We called the Red Cross, we called a couple of other funds, the answer was, the answer initially we didn't get for a few days because everyone was still trying to figure things out and organize themselves to provide the aid and that was going to needed to be provided. And while we were, you know, waiting for these answers, we decided to pursue a parallel track and to set up a fund ourselves in the event the worst happened and some of the large relief agencies did not, in fact, take care of our families like they were taking care of other families. So we did set up the September 11th Gay and Lesbian Fund, and about $379,000 over the next few months were donated to that fund by individuals all across the country, lesbian, gay, bi, trans, straight, several foundations, churches, people that sold burritos, I remember, on the street, bars that would have fundraisers, all giving what they could give to that fund. And eventually, over the next few months, about 22 survivors stepped forward and were able to document their relationships to us, and we did distribute over 17,000 to each of them. But in the meantime, we pursued this other track with relief agencies because we knew that the large dollars were really with groups like the Red Cross.
All right, and along that track, eventually, one of the survivors was Sheila Hine, I believe, and she was in the Pentagon's Office
right.
of Management and Budget,
right.
and she was survived by Peggy Neff, and
right.
forgive me if I'm butchering these names, and she was Peggy Neff was the first to receive federal aid under the Michael Judge Act. Michael Judge was a chaplain ministering to the New York Fire Department at Ground Zero who died. He was officially the 17th victim of the attacks.
Mm-hmm. There were over the following few months and years, there were a number of funds that were set up, some of which survivors, LGBT survivors, received, were eligible for, and some of which it was very kind of uneven depending upon the individual situation. I think the fund that you're speaking of, the Michael Judge. That was there was federal legislation passed that was applicable to
non-biological survivors of families if their biological survivors either consented or cannot be found.
I think you're actually talking about the federal fund.
Yeah.
There was the federal fund, which was a large fund that the Congress established, and we actually monitored that very closely because our concerns were obvious. Our federal government has never recognized our family in any context whatsoever. And so we actually began a rather concerted effort here in New York State with letters being sent from Governor Pataki, Mayor Giuliani, Attorney General Spitzer, U.S. Senator Schumer, and others urging the federal fund to provide for the domestic partners of survivors and not just recognize spouses. We wanted the same kind of expansive definition of family that eventually the Red Cross provided and some of the other relief agencies. And what the federal government did was really, at the end of the day, they kind of took a pass on that question, and they said, look, we'll do what the states do where those survivors are from. If those survivors have a will and set up their domestic partner as the executor of their estate, we will recognize them as the executor of that person, of the funds that person, the survivor, will receive through the federal fund. And so, in fact, there were a number of the survivors who had wills with their partners, and they were named as the executor of the will, and that did put that survivor in the driver's seat in terms of the federal fund. There were others who, like many people in this country, don't go through the process of putting a will together. You know, when you're married, if your partner dies and you don't have a will, you're automatically the beneficiary of it without a will because you're married. In our case, you know, with our family still today, you know, we have to hire those attorneys and pay the fees and do what we need to do to take care of each other in the event something happens to one of us. For those that had not done that, they really were going to be depending upon the blood relatives and whether or not the blood relatives were going to provide for them. And some of the survivors were on good terms with the blood relatives of their partner, and so the blood relatives included them in for a portion of the federal fund that they received. A number of others were not on good terms with the blood relatives or were invisible to the blood relatives for reasons that we're very familiar with if you're gay, lesbian, bi, and trans. And they had difficulties and in most cases were left out in the cold in terms of the federal fund.
Joe, this is Deborah Bell, and I just want to point out that you have Texas connections. Graduated from the University of Texas in Austin and worked for U.S. House of Representative Texas Congressman Solomon Ortiz.
And I'm from Port Arthur, Texas, about 90 miles from Houston.
The infamous Port Arthur, Texas. tell me about... because you were working with the gay and lesbian survivors of the and victims, how did you go about building the bipartisan support that resulted in the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act in New York State the following year? And what exactly does that act do?
I think when we passed the Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act, it's kind of referred to as a statewide gay rights bill. We were, I believe, the 13th state in the country to pass a bill. And that bill provided protections based upon sexual orientation. Since then, there have been an additional, three or four states that have passed bills that provided protections based upon sexual orientation and gender identity and expression. For quite a few years there, states passed bills that just provided protections based upon sexual orientation. We were kind of the last of a number of states that did that. Now all the states that have done that have included gender identity and expression. And I think it's an issue of there's much more understanding about trans issues now, not only around the country, but in New York State and within our community. And we've seen a number of localities pass trans non-discrimination bills, including New York City in 2002. And that's typically the way that you pass bills in New York State on the statewide level, is you start on the state and county level. The way that we've been able to do, because we do have a Senate, a state Senate that's been controlled by the Republicans for decades, the Assembly's been controlled by the Democrats, and the governorship tends to bounce back and forth between the two political parties. We have been able to build bipartisan support around many of our issues, not all of them. I think it's probably, Republicans up here are Northeastern Republicans, and they're kind of different from Republicans in Texas when it comes to social issues.
Mm-hmm. On that note, currently up in New York is AB 4097, or Senate, or SB 2055, which is the same-sex marriage ban, which was introduced and which was recently cited as a judge for denying insurance coverage to a partner of a lesbian woman going to state college. I believe it is a community
in Monroe County, which is the county. Rochester's in Monroe County, out in western New York.
And this follows as kind of 5 years afterwards. What's happened?
It's interesting what's happened with 9/11. There was a period, obviously, here where, we were all in this together here in New York City, and there was a period of a number of months where I think, New York City, New York State, much of the nation understood that, we need to be looking for what unites us rather than what divides us. And in New York State, following 9/11, everything that the state of New York did to take care of families, of spouses, of people who could get married, was also done for domestic partners. And there were a series of bills that passed in Albany where domestic partners of 9/11 only, or same-sex survivors of 9/11 only, were provided with workers' compensation death benefits, which is a tremendous benefit because you get that in perpetuity, essentially, with access to education scholarships for the domestic partners and their children, for college, and for a number of other things. And so that was a great breakthrough for our community, but it was obviously for survivors of 9/11 only. And we began advocating in Albany for our families and saying if it's good enough for 9/11, why is it good enough for our families in all occasions? And what happened with 9/11 is those bills that were passed were the first examples ever in the history of our legislature and in New York state law that domestic partners were recognized in any context whatsoever. And what's happened since those bills were passed in 2002 is that we've been able to pass almost every year another bill or two that provides an additional benefit for domestic partners, like hospital visitation in 2003 and control of a partner's remains in 2004, and several other bills that provide some other rights. But what has happened is we had a legislature that refused to recognize domestic partners in our families, and once 9/11 came along, it's kind of become much less of an issue, and we're able now to start picking rights one by one. Obviously, we would prefer to pass, you know, we're now in the situation where we are going to need to pass a marriage equality bill, since our high court ruled in July that the law as they've interpreted it does not allow the state to issue licenses to our families. So obviously now we have before us, you know, we're going to be working to pass a marriage bill. And 9/11 in many ways, it was much about the debate about who is family and who does government recognize as family. And in fact, you know, the HIV crisis, which is still a crisis, but, you know, many of us may have remembered losing quite a few friends in the 1980s and 90s to HIV. I know instances of where blood relatives shut out the domestic partners of their son from the hospital room, and in many ways 9/11 and obviously what we're fighting for today, marriage, it's all about the definition of who is family and who does our government recognize as family.
All right, thank you. That was Joe Tarver of the
Empire State Pride Agenda.
Thank you.
In New York. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening. This is LSR Sleba on 90.1 KPFT, and you've been listening to Queer Voices.
I tend to write when I have a big emotional event happening. And everyone was emotional after, you know, the towers went down. And about a week after that happened, I was watching the news, because all I could do was watch CNN and the news. And I was watching all the people with the pictures of their loved ones and all the hope, and they're going to find them. And it was just heart-wrenching. So I just picked up my guitar, because that's many times makes me feel better, or at least helps me get these things out of, I don't know, deep inside, and helps me bring it out so I feel better. And so I spent all day in my studio at home and just was just crying the entire time, feeling every word. And I think a lot of people can relate to that song too. It's very descriptive of the events. It's not hugely patriotic. It's just more of what I saw and my take on the emotion of the human emotion of it.
Listen to me. cry. Some rose from the ashes, the rest said goodbye. I thought I knew brave, thought I knew inspiration. Tried to tear us apart, but they inspired a nation. The towers are lying.
This is JD, and you just heard Anne Engel. I interviewed her early in 2002, and she gave me that introduction quote about her song about 9/11 called Song for America.
This is Queer Voices.
This is Deborah Bell as we continue our special programming in memory of the fifth anniversary of the terrorist attacks on New York City and the Pentagon on September 11th, 2001, along with
LSR Salima,
Jennifer Renee.
As the days went by, we learned that some of the missing rescue personnel were gay and that many of their lovers, some of whom are cops and firefighters, were grieving in silence for fear of outing them. There were also gay cops that lost family members that were rescue personnel. We all learned too quickly and in too cruel a way that the closet is a terrible place to grieve. So said Edgar Rodriguez, NYPD. And in memory of...
In the memory of September 11th, we are commemorating those who died during those events. And I'm going to start with Father Michael Judge, the openly gay New York City Fire Department Catholic chaplain, who is 68, who was killed while ministering to a fallen firefighter at Ground Zero. Judge's helmet was presented to the Pope, and he's currently up for sainthood. Not officially, but there's a strong movement for it. There was also, in June 2002, there was the President signed the Michael Judge Act, which allowed surviving non-biological family members to receive benefits from the federal aid fund. After that, we have Mark Bingham, a gay passenger on United Airlines Flight 93 that crashed into Pennsylvania, and he helped to take down the plane's hijackers. September 16th is officially designated Mark Bingham Day in San Francisco.
And 46-year-old Carol Plavix, plane the American Airlines Flight 11, never made it to California. It was the first of two to crash into the World Trade Center. Plavix, who was registered a nurse and a member of the Human Rights Campaign, is survived by Nancy Walsh, her partner of nearly 13 years. David Sharbolds, The co-pilot of American Airlines Flight 77, which crashed into the Pentagon, was openly gay, the Washington Blade reported. Charbols was a member of the National Gay Pilots Association. Charbols is survived by Tom Hay, his partner of nearly 13 years. Graham Berkeley, 37, was a native of England who lived in Boston. United Airlines Flight 173 on September 11th. On his way to Los Angeles, wherever that is. Well, I know where Los Angeles is. He died when the plane became the second hijacked plane to crash into the World Trade Center. Pamela Boyce, 43, is only one of several dozen World Trade Center workers who have officially been confirmed dead. Boyce, a resident of Dyker Heights, Brooklyn, worked on the 92nd floor of One World Trade Center as assistant vice president of accounting for the New York office of Car Futures. She is survived by her partner, Kathleen Amello.
Emergency aid kept Margaret Cruz afloat after the loss of her partner of 18 years, Patricia McAnini. Ms. Cruz documented her financially interdependent partnership and prevailed with the Crime Victims Board, the Red Cross, and the New York State Charitable Fund. A total of $80,000 went to Ms. Cruz. McAnini, age 50, was the fire marshal of her floor of the number one World Trade Center, where she worked for the insurance company Guy Carpenter. Waleska Martinez, age 37, a computer whiz in the Census Bureau's New York office, was aboard Flight 93 that crashed outside Shanksville, Pennsylvania. In his book, Among the Heroes, Jerry Longman unobtrusively quotes Ana Lopez, her same-sex partner. She was my longtime companion, my best friend, soulmate. Openly gay flight attendant Jeffrey Coleman's American Airlines Flight 11 from Boston smashed into the North Tower of the New York World Trade Center. Coleman is survived by Keith Brodkowski, his partner of 11 years. 41-year-old John Cohen was at work near the World Trade Center when the planes hit. He was killed by falling debris. He worked at 1 Liberty Plaza near the World Trade Center and died when the towers collapsed. After the planes hit the Trade Center towers, Cohen met Mike Lines, his partner of 17 years, on the street and called his mother from his cell phone. They were just in the streets like everybody else, Keohane's sister, Darlene Keohane, told the San Francisco Chronicle. As he was talking, he had thought a third plane had crashed into the building. What Keohane thought was a third crash was really the collapse of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. While Lines survived, Keohane was killed by the debris. Tragically, Lines committed suicide in March of 2002. Sheila Hain, who was a Defense of Freedom Medal recipient, was working for the U.S. Army's Management and Budget Office at the Pentagon when American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into it. Peggy Neff is Hines' partner of 18 years. Virginia's Criminal Injuries Compensation Fund administrators refused to accept the couple were anything but friends. However, in January 2003, the federal government's 9/11 Compensation Fund approved what is said to be the first payment of a person in a gay relationship whose partner was killed in the terrorist attacks.
Since September 11th, friends of Michael Lepore Since September 11th, friends of Michael Lepore, 39, a project analyst for Marsh McLennan have been pruning his rose bushes, clearing the wayward ivy off the stone walls, planting bulbs for next spring. It is a perfect act of kindness, said Lepore's partner of 18 years, David O'Leary. Their house and garden in Yonkers had been Mr. Lepore's pride and joy, and now Mr. O'Leary, are now Mr. O'Leary's primary source of comfort, according to the New York Times. Next up, John Winter and his lover, William Anthony Carnes, 37, lived in sight of Carnes' office at Marsh and McLennan on the 97th floor of the World Trade Center Tower 1. Walking to the office together, the couple had timed the commute at just 11 minutes. On the morning of September 11th, Carnes, who went by Tony, left his office at 8:30. And at 8:45, Winter had heard what sounded like a thunderclap. When he looked out of his apartment window, he can see the future. Carnes was killed in that morning's attacks. And in dealing in the aftermath, Winter said that he was fortunate in having a good relationship with Tony's family in Knoxville. This was from Paul Schneider of LGNY.com. New York resident Tom Miller lost his partner, Seamus O'Neill, in the World Trade Center attack. He was quoted as saying, "I did not have the luxury of grieving without having to defend myself and prove who I am and who we were. If down the road anyone can be spared that torture, then that would be excellent," he said.
Roxy Eddie Oglenberg, I believe, a beloved member of the Renegades of New York Big Apple Softball League, was tragically lost in the September 11th World Trade Center attack. He worked as a bond trader for Keefe's, Breggett, and Wands in the 109th floor of the West Tower. Jerry Roscoe, Renegades for the Oglethorpe.
Francis S. Coppola, a New York City detective whose partner, a firefighter named Eddie, died in the attacks, summed up the bipolar feelings many GLBT people have about September 11th. "I have never been more proud of being an American or a New Yorker, but at the same time, it has made me sad. The greatest country in the world, and yet we are treated like second-class citizens. The great love of my life died doing what he did best and what he loved to do, helping others. I've never been an activist or ever wanted to be one. However, it is time we stand up and be counted and demand equality, nothing more or nothing less." So said his partner. So that's some of the people from our community that were affected on this day. I know many others were. There's so many that we'll probably never know about. We'll just bid them adieu hope that we never have to face another event like this again in this country or any other. And now we go to music. Thanks for listening to Queer Voices.
This is JD, and this coming Wednesday, KPFT sponsors Amy Goodman at the Houston Scottish Rite Center at 7575 Brompton. The reason I'm interested in it is because warming up for her is the group Emma's Revolution, which I'm familiar with. They will also be giving their own concert Thursday night at the Unitarian Fellowship of Houston. For info on that, www.ufoh.org. Emma's Revolution and This Love.
Stood up for things that it took that were mine. Without the money, I eventually got back in line. And the cuts that were left on my skin came and went away. I thought then that this was the end. All the times I've turned around, something else to see that came along, the taste and the sound. Could there ever be a way to erase the part, to take the star right out of the way? I knew there would be loneliness, and I knew there would be anger, yet was prepared for the heart of financially. No matter if it was worth it emotionally. They see a pretty face and they get the feel of me. Refuse to reveal my truth. I look for reasons why they're waiting to leave the room. There is a way out of this. I wish I'd broken down the walls of time to alleviate this. But the words that were left in my head, with the birds that are singing now, are all dead. I knew there would be loneliness, and I knew all about the anger, yet was prepared for the heart to financially. No matter if it was worth it emotionally. What I didn't know, you left the monster in me. You left the monster in me. And what I didn't know, you stole the lightning in me. You stole the lightning in me. Yeah, yeah.
Very Out of the Closet song was by Dallas area artist Patrick Booth from his debut album, Finally the View Has Changed. You can visit Patrick at patrickbooth.net.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Well, J.D., I guess we're just part of the crew, aren't we?
We're part of the crew.
Gosh. Well, this is Jennifer and I. We're here with Tim Brookover, the GLBT Community Center.
Hello.
What's going on at the Community Center?
Well, it is a pleasure to be here, as always. What we should talk about first, I think, is the status of Queer Bingo.
Queer Voices, yes. Grant's here. Come on, let's tell us about Queer Bingo.
Queer Bingo is a bingo fundraiser that we have held since December on the third Saturday of the month at 1415 California. It has been a tremendous success and a great deal of fun. I think everybody who has attended has agreed. Several months ago, because of the success, the community center decided to convert our temporary license to a permanent license. Our bingo game is an official Texas Lottery Commission bingo, so we're serious bingo. In order to do that, it's just a lot of paperwork. Unfortunately, we have been stymied because we're in the great Texas bureaucratic machine. The Lottery Commission told us when we approached them about changing our license that it would take about 3 months minimum. And it turns out they were right. We are in the third month and we still haven't heard. And until that license is converted, we are not allowed by Texas Lottery Commission regulation to hold bingo. So probably, again in September, we will not have Queer Bingo, which normally would have been this Saturday.
Oh, that's disappointing, because I've been there. I've enjoyed it
so much.
What
makes it so queer?
Well, it's a lot of queer folks playing. It's hosted by the Houston GLBT Community Center, which is about as queer as you can get. Our co-host every month is the wonderful drag diva Cinnamon. We have a theme every month, which has ranged in the past from sports to a disco night. We encourage people to wear costumes and
can you do a country one?
Campy as you want to be. That's actually on the books coming up. Once we get the approval to start having bingo again, we'll resume. The last I heard was it hadn't been approved for September.
So it's because you applied for being official, you can't have it. If you hadn't applied, you could still be having it.
What happens is we had originally applied for a temporary license, which is 6 months. And because we kind of wanted to see
how
it went. I mean, it's possible that we could have done it and nobody would have come, but that isn't what happened. So then that temporary license only goes 6 months. So basically, you can either apply for another temporary license or you can convert it to a permanent, and it's less expensive and less time consuming, as I understand it, just to convert to a permanent license.
Well, you could have changed names like Tranny Bingo or Dyke Bingo.
I suppose we could have. Fortunately, Christopher Bound, who is our very capable president, is kind of the bingo maven, and he's been handling all this and the state regulations, and they're very...
dot those I's, cross those T's.
They're very careful. So in turn, we're very careful. And as I say, they had told us that it would be 3 months the minimum, and we're like, we'll be up and running before you know it. But, they say that for a reason. It's been 3 months, and we're still waiting.
And more time to make it better.
More time to make it better. Once we're back, which, as I say, we hope will be the third Saturday in October, as we head into the fall.
That'll be Halloween bingo.
Halloween bingo.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Absolutely be Halloween bingo.
And I guess costumes are okay?
Costumes are encouraged. Costumes, boas, tiaras, crowns, whatever.
Well, that's usually what you wear, isn't it?
Normal dress code, yeah.
All of these. My normal streetwear. So, yeah, we have been, we're caught in this sort of the bureaucratic machine, but we have every expectation that it will be approved. In fact, Christopher Bound has talked to the folks at the Lottery Commission. They said there's no problem. You just have to be in line with everybody else. And, we hate that part. We're queers. We should be moved to the front of the line.
Don't they know how special we are?
Well, they should know. They just don't understand.
Those pesky Republicans.
That's right. I blame them. But
what other events are going on at the community
center? We have some other exciting news. This isn't necessarily an event, but it's a new program that we're starting. This will happen in later in October. The community center is going to start publishing an online journal of writing and art, which will launch sometime in late October. It's going to be called Montrose Journal of Art and Writing. As I said, will only be online. The beginning will be twice a year. Then perhaps sometime in late 2007 we will increase frequency to quarterly. The plan is that will eventually become quarterly. We realize there really isn't a venue for people in the community who are poets, fiction writers, essayists, who write journals, to get their work out there. And to publish is so prohibitively expensive.
Hmm.
So we are going to... we're not inventing the wheel. This has really become quite a part of the internet. People who publish these online literary magazines, for lack of a better term, and it's become a wonderful venue for people to get their work published or to get their work out. You know, you hate to use the word, even to use the word publishing, but to get their work out there so people can read it, and it's on the World Wide Web. So the Community Center is the publisher. Outsmart Magazine is our publishing partner, providing some guidance, providing some help along the way. And this, as I said, this will launch in late October. Then we will have another issue in the spring, and a third issue in late 2007. And then by then, we hope we'll be able to convert to quarterly.
Is it just written work, or you mentioned use the word art?
It's written work. Thank you. Written work, and then we'll also primarily written work, but then we'll also have at least one visual artist,
like photography
or. Probably primarily photography, but then because that reproduces
something. Right, a photo of a painting, hard to capture.
Exactly. We do have in the first issue we have a photographer, we have several poets, someone who's we have a couple of writers who are providing kind of humorous essays, and then once we. A couple of us on the board have really put together this first issue. Then our plan is to recruit from within the community people who want to serve on it and
like
advisory board.
Moderator of sorts.
Right. And then that will create some sort of board or panel that will then accept work and make decisions about work.
Yeah, that was one of my questions. How would you submit something to this?
The best thing to do now, because really I'm spearheading this, is either to call the center at 713-524-3818 or to contact me at timbrookover@gmail.com. As far as for going ahead, for this first issue, we've got it pretty much set. But definitely we're looking at having at least two more issues in 2007.
Where's the website?
The website, it hasn't quite been determined. It will have its own website. It's
on
its own
the
URL.
Internet.
On the internet. Part of it's a community center website issue. But because our website will be a part of the community center website and will be linked to the website. But once you start talking about that, you're getting over my level of expertise. There will be a website.
Go to the community center website. There will be a link.
Yes. It's not there now because it hasn't been released yet, but it will be there. And the community center website is HoustonGLBTCommunityCenter.org.
Oh, good. Now, you're talking about this one in October. What's going on right now in the community center? Don't you have some other events or items going on?
Well,
I know you.
A lot of activity that's going on right now. Of course, we have the number of groups use the center for their offices and headquarters, and then also their regular meetings. Those groups include the Political Caucus, Houston Equal Rights Alliance, PFLAG Houston, a number of other groups in the community, the Houston Big Men's Club, Texas Association for Transsexual Support. There's always a great deal of activity going on at the center presented by these groups. Right now, a lot of the activity that you see going on is really directed by the Political Caucus and Houston Equal Rights Alliance as they gear up for elections.
That's right. There's one coming up in November, isn't there?
There is. I heard there's an election, and there's a great deal of activity.
It's been in all the papers.
The political caucus and HERA, which have offices at the center, are doing a great deal of work, as you guys may have already talked about this evening, block walking for Ellen Cohen and Hubert Vaux and other candidates, and really trying to get the word out about the election and get the vote out, and also get word out about all the endorsements that the caucus has made this election cycle.
Now, give us the telephone number again and your website again.
The phone number is 713-524-3818. The website for the Community Center is HoustonGLBTCommunityCenter.org.
And one more time, if they want to be part of this magazine in the next issue, not the one coming up, but the next issue, they'll contact you. How?
You could either call the center at 524-3818 or contact me directly at timbrookover@gmail.com.
All right. What else is going on? Anything? I want to give you the last shot.
Just in my other life, I'm the editor of Outsmart.
I thought you wanted to say something
magazine about
that.
Yeah, and I just encourage people to pick that up. It's free for at many locations around the community and around the city, or you could pick it up at 3406 Audubon, our address, or look us up on the World Wide Web at OutsmartMagazine.com. Our October issue, which is coming up, will be our annual Gayest and Greatest issue, in which we present our annual reader poll, which is always a lot of fun to see what people vote for in the community. And also we have some great election coverage in October. Then we'll also have a little bit more in November, but we really put a lot of our coverage in the October issue, including a list of all the caucus endorsements, so be sure and look at that, and as well as some other really wonderful pieces. So I hope you'll pick up the magazine and take a look.
Thank you. We've been talking with Tim Brookover at the GLBT Community Center. This is Jennifer Poole.
And J.D. Doyle.
And this is Queer Voices.
See you holding hands with another man. Now you come on home. Wall to wall smiles. Tell me you love me. It's been too long a while. Well, my sweet baby, put that bite mark there. No, you won't hide it with that guilty stare. Walking around my hometown, putting me down. You hurt me badly. Now I'm angry. Before you go out the door, we're gonna settle the score. Give me the house, give me the ring. Everything, everything. So walk away in silence. Show me that you're strong. And then tell your new friend about how I did you wrong. Perfect, that is true. But God help the next man who ends up with walking around my hometown, putting me down. You hurt me badly.
heaven's sake. I want everything. I've got tired of waiting on you, my dear. I want everything.
I love that song. That was Steve Cohen, and that song came from an album of his that I consider a gay classic. The album is called Silent Too Long. The song was I Want Everything.
This is Queer Voices. And now from the fertile and entirely democratic cornfields of Iowa, here is Joan Devlin. Joan? Joan?
She's in the wrong end.
Okay, try it again. Joan?
Yes, hi.
There you are. Okay, go. Joan?
Yes, okay. Good evening. You're listening to Queer Voices, and we have on the phone with us Steve, and I'm going to probably pronounce this wrong, Rawls from the Service Members Legal Defense Network. Is that the correct pronunciation of your last name?
We don't have anyone else on the phone, Joan. If he's not on at your end, he's not on here either.
Oh, great. Okay.
Okay, well, tell you what. Let's do. Let's play another segment from This Way Out, and while we take care of that problem, and we'll come back to you. How's that?
That sounds good.
Okay.
Many critics of the U.S. LGBT movement's current emphasis on marriage equality cite the lack of federal workplace discrimination protections as one of the other priorities they say are being forsaken. Those same two issues were vying for attention in the U.S. Senate 10 years ago this month, when what started out as one bill became DOMA, the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, and ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. The arguments for and against ENDA in the Senate, a first-time ever discussion of lesbian-gay civil rights on the floor of either House of Congress, sound like they could have been recorded last week. Here's how Pacifica Radio's Verna Avery Brown reported the day's impassioned debate on September 6, 1996.
Today, the Senate debated the merits of Democrat Ted Kennedy's bill, which bars employers from using sexual orientation as a basis for hiring, firing, or demoting a worker. The same protection already extended on the basis of race, gender, or disabilities.
There are not adequate existing laws to protect individuals who experience that kind of a discrimination. This legislation is a very measured, targeted piece of legislation to deal with bigotry and discrimination in the workplace, carefully drafted, carefully targeted to that issue.
Kennedy's bill exempts the armed forces and nonprofit religious organizations. Statistics will not be used to show anti-gay discrimination, and quotas are prohibited. Still, Republican Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas says the bill goes too far in legal remedies and victims should just get back their jobs and back pay.
I agree there is discrimination that does exist. However, our courts are already clogged with cases which many times only lead to more divisiveness and disruption in the workplace.
Illinois Democrat Paul Simon, co-sponsor of the bill, argued that the Senate should be creating job opportunities, not limiting them. And he recalled the testimony of one woman who had been fired because of her sexual orientation.
Now I'm going to mention the company's name, Cracker Barrel. I haven't been into a Cracker Barrel restaurant since that woman testified. And I'm not going to go into one until we pass legislation like this. But her separation notice read, let me repeat it again. This employee is being terminated due to a violation of company policy. The employee is gay. That was a woman who worked as a cook. Very low wages. When she testified before our committee, she was working part-time cutting firewood. What kind of a society are we building? People were not made by God all the same. Some of us have brown hair, some of us red hair, some of us black hair, some blonde. Some were made with a different sexual orientation than most of us have. And we should not deny them employment opportunities.
But opponents argued the bill's exemptions for churches and nonprofit organizations don't extend far enough, leaving out businesses that might have moral objections to homosexuality. Oklahoma Republican Don Nichols.
Well, what about a Christian bookstore, for example?
Christian bookstore for profit doesn't fall under the exemption. But it's a for-profit bookstore, Christian bookstore, or Jewish bookstore, Muslim bookstore, they would be liable to be sued if they didn't hire somebody who was openly gay. And that may be very reprehensible to them and their basic beliefs. And yet they could be sued. What about the Boy Scouts? They've had a policy and they've been sued. Didn't even have sexual orientation under the Civil Rights Act, and yet they're in court and have been in court, has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to maintain their policy. They do not want to have openly homosexuals as their scout masters and leaders and employees in their organization.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein argues that similar legislation she passed in California some 20 years ago has never drawn complaints from the business community.
Is it inappropriate conduct for anybody to be kissing on their job as a waiter or a waitress? The answer is yes, it's inappropriate conduct, regardless of whether they're gay or straight. The same thing goes for clothing. If it's inappropriate to wear certain things in the workplace, this is true whether you're gay or whether you're straight. So a lot of the hobgoblins that are expressed by the other side, that this will open the world to all kinds of inappropriate activity, in my view, based on 25 years of watching a piece of legislation which I authored, which was passed, which I presided over as mayor of a city, is simply not correct.
Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy authored the measure and rose to its defense.
What is going to be the message to the young people of this country? Our message is that you should not discriminate. You should not be part of a sense of bigotry in this nation. That is what is the underlying theme of this legislation. Mr. President, I was around here not that long ago when we were making progress on eliminating discrimination, and we found out that a number of years ago when we were talking about knocking down the walls of discrimination on race, we said, well, blacks don't work hard. Blacks are lazy. Blacks aren't competent. They're different. Why do we need to provide any kind of protection for them? Well, we did. We don't even hear a dispute about that particular issue at this time. Then we had the issue about protecting women. Women are weak. Women belong in the home. Women are not smart enough. Why should women be involved in athletics? We passed Title IX. And we all celebrated when we got gold medals in basketball, softball, and saw the success of our magnificent women Olympians, our gymnasts and others in this last Olympics. No one's making those arguments. And now we have the stereotyping of gay and lesbians, those child molesters that are out there. Everyone who is gay can't wait to get their hands on a young child. And we are stereotyping it for one more time. Mr. President, I thought we knew better than that.
That was Edward Kennedy in September 1996 arguing for his Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, in a report by Verna Avery Brown. To no one's surprise, the notorious Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, passed the Senate on September 10th of that year by a landslide 85-14 vote, even greater than the earlier 5-1 margin it enjoyed in the House. ENDA failed by one vote in the Senate on the same day, although it certainly would have been soundly defeated in the even more conservative Republican-controlled House. DOMA was signed into law without fanfare in the wee hours of the night by President Bill Clinton. The late Senator Paul Simon did live to see the day that Cracker Barrel Restaurants rescinded its ban on gay and lesbian employees. The latest version of ENDA, despite bipartisan support, still languishes in the current Republican-controlled Congress.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, it's a good thing that we don't rest on formality around here, Joan. We managed to have you hooked up with your guest now. And actually, it's a real nice follow-on to the piece that we just played from This Way Out.
Yes, it is. And we have with us tonight Steve. And Steve, I'm afraid I'm going to mispronounce your last name. Steve Rawls from the Service Members Legal Defense Network.
that a correct pronunciation?
You got it correct.
Now, that is a good follow-on because, you know, today is September 11th. It is the anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center. And where do gays fit into Homeland Security?
Since September 11th, 2001, SLDN has fielded numerous phone calls from gays and lesbians who very much want to be a part of our Homeland Security efforts and our response to the war on terrorism. And unfortunately, because of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell ban, they are not given the opportunity to be a part of that military response.
And that includes those who speak languages that it is very hard to find individuals, you know, that speak these languages, that speak Arabic and other languages. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Since 1993, more than 11,000 people have been dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That includes more than 300 language specialists. And of those 300, at least 54 were fluent in Arabic, which is, of course, a very in-demand language at the Department of Defense today.
So what you're saying is it's less important to perhaps figure out coded messages so we can prevent another terror attack than it is to fire someone for being gay.
That seems to be the attitude at the Pentagon today. The axis of evil that George Bush often refers to, Korean languages, Arabic languages, Farsi languages, are actually three of the areas with the most discharges since Don't Ask, Don't Tell went into effect.
That's a little scary.
It is, and it should be of concern, I think, to every American that today in the U.S. military, commanders are issuing waivers to allow recruits who don't meet physical fitness standards, who don't meet educational standards, and in some cases, who can't even pass a criminal background check, to allow those individuals to enlist in the military because of the recruitment problems that we're facing. And all the while, every day, at least two gay or lesbian service members are being fired.
Let's talk about this a little bit more. We are talking to Steve Rawls from the Service Members Legal Defense Network. We saw an article the other day, Deborah Bell forwarded this to me, that says most of the service members impacted by Don't Ask, Don't Tell are female.
That's true. Women are about 15 to 16% of the active duty force, and they're about 30% of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell dismissals. And it's been historically true since the implementation of the law that women are very disproportionately impacted by the ban. I think that's due in part to the military belief that a female in a non-traditional job role must be a lesbian. And there's also a long history of lesbian baiting in the armed forces. So women are especially vulnerable because of this law.
Now, what can a service member do if they are dismissed for being gay or lesbian?
A service member who is actually dismissed, unfortunately, doesn't have a lot of options. Right now, they're not allowed to reenlist in the military, and their best chance for career advancement after the armed forces is to make sure that they receive an honorable discharge, if that's what their service record merits, and that they leave with the educational and health care benefits that are available to veterans. But in terms of a future career in the armed forces, the current law actually forbids that, and service members who are dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell leave the armed forces with paperwork that actually has a homosexual stamp on it that many civilian employers know to look for.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then you're pretty much branded for life. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
That's correct. And if you think about the composition of our armed forces, it includes many people who come from conservative small-town America, and that includes gays and lesbians to see the military as an opportunity for career advancement and educational opportunities, and they're sent back home to what may be a very hostile environment, and they've essentially been outed by the federal government.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this, because not everyone who gets discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell is necessarily gay. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are certainly heterosexuals who are dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. A perfect example is a recent case that we had at FLDN of a 19-year Air Force officer who was married with three children and who had a complaint filed against him by the civilian wife of one of his fellow officers. She said she saw him kiss a man at a holiday party, and as a result of that, despite his 19 years of stellar service and despite his family and his career, he was dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And the law has really become a very effective weapon of vengeance for anyone who wants to blackmail or jeopardize a service member's career. Rumor, innuendo, and finger-pointing is a very effective weapon in the military today.
And, you know, I've heard complaints from women as well that a lot of times they can be accused of being gay simply because they're approached for a date or for sex, and they say no.
Absolutely. That often happens, and it's also the case that female commanders in the military who are supervising young male employees and may not give the most favorable performance review are often also labeled as lesbians as a way to exact revenge on their poor performance reviews of their subordinates.
So really what you're saying is Don't Ask, Don't Tell has just become a very easy way for the military to advance sexism.
It is. It's a homophobic policy. It's a sexist policy. And despite the conservative right-wing's best efforts, they can't seem to come up with a solid justification for keeping it in place anymore.
Now, what does the Service Members Legal Defense Network do exactly?
FLDN is a two-pronged organization. We provide free and confidential legal counsel to service members who are impacted in any way by Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And we also have a policy and lobby arm here in Washington, D.C., where we work on Capitol Hill for repeal of the law, and we work with our contacts at the Pentagon in the interim to ensure the best possible implementation.
Now, you would think that this war on terror, this post-9/11 world we live in that Bush loves to talk about, you would think, if anything, that would have made Don't Ask, Don't Tell a moot point. Because you would think that if we are in danger, if we are fighting the axis of evil, the most important thing is to have the most qualified people out in front to help save us. And you're telling me that it's actually gone the opposite direction, that it's actually become even more prevalent to dismiss people for being gay?
Right. We've actually seen the first increase in the number of gay and lesbian discharges since September 11th, 2001, just this past year. And that increase included one of the service members who rescued Jessica Lynch when she was held hostage during the war. It included Army Specialist Jeff Howe, who was on his second tour of duty in Baghdad and who was actually airlifted by helicopter out of Baghdad in the middle of the night, brought home, and fired because his command suspected that he is gay.
That really bothers me because we're in Iraq, and these people are more worried about who their troops are potentially sleeping with and doing their job. That's what you're telling me?
That's correct, and it should be very worrisome. And I think that many people in the LGBT community don't really understand that there actually is a policy at the federal government level where gays are hunted down, fired from their job, and essentially branded for the rest of their lives. And if Walmart or Starbucks or any other corporation was firing 2 to 3 people every day because of their sexual orientation, we would be rightfully outraged. And when the military does it, who happens to be the largest employer in the country, we should be equally outraged, if not more so, because it's done under the direction of a federal mandate.
And what is it, you know, we've heard these before, but just to reiterate for our audience, what is the reason behind this? Because personally, if I'm in a war zone, I don't really care who you choose to sleep with on your off time. I just want you to have my back in a war zone.
Right. And you would think that that would be the first priority of the U.S. military. And what's really interesting is that right now in Baghdad, U.S. service members are serving alongside and, in fact, sharing living quarters with openly gay British troops. The British military has not had a ban for about 7 years now. And someone recently asked the Pentagon if they had received a single complaint from an American service member who was uncomfortable serving with a gay British soldier or felt that they were unable to do so. And the Pentagon's response was, well, actually, no. Not a single American soldier had complained about that. And so that completely undercuts any rationale that the Department of Defense is putting out there for this policy, because the men and women in the field, just as you said, care whether someone has their back, whether they're going to stop the bullet, if they're Jessica Lynch, whether they're going to be rescued, and not really about who their comrade is in love with or is sleeping with at the end of the day.
What advice would you give to someone who is currently in the service or thinking about going into the service and is gay or lesbian? What would you advise them to do?
Well, service members who are currently serving need to be aware that they have a legal resource, an SLDN, and that the most important thing they can do if they're ever questioned about their sexual orientation is to say nothing and sign nothing and call the attorneys at SLDN for assistance. Gays and lesbians who are considering enlisting often are doing that because of the same reason as their straight neighbors. They want the educational opportunity, the career opportunities, and the military really does have a benefits package that's second to none. But they also need to be really informed and educated about what the reality of don't ask, don't tell is. And it's not as simple as its name implies. Service members are routinely investigated, routinely fired, and those are men and women who are keeping their end of the don't tell deal. So young men and women who happen to be gay or lesbian who are thinking about a career in the military should really visit our website at fldn.org. We have lots of information about how the policy is implemented and make sure that they educate themselves before they make that decision.
I just find this shocking because, as you said earlier, people are being so heavily recruited now. You know, my friend, her son graduated from high school, and she had recruiters calling her 3 to 6 times a day trying to talk to him and trying to convince him to join the military. And, you know, for someone right out of high school who maybe hasn't even figured out their sexual orientation yet, this has to be a little scary because you have a lot of information being thrown out at you. And like you said, I don't think you go in knowing, you know, just how any little thing can potentially cause you to not only lose your career in the military, but keep you from a civilian career.
Joan, sorry to interrupt, but you have 1 minute left.
Okay, thank you.
And that's absolutely correct. You're absolutely right. And young men and women, I don't think completely understand the nuances of the policy. And that's why SLDN has been around since 1993 to provide that information. And any of your listeners who have questions can go to our website, contact us through there, and we're happy to provide any counsel that we can.
Great. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Steve Rawls of the Service Members Legal Defense Network. Steve, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I know it's kind of late there in D.C., but we do appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
A number of films have been released in the 5 years since the events of 9/11/2001. This Way Out's Steve Pride brings us his favorite and probably most unconventional of the pack. WTC View was just released on DVD and is screening this month on U.S. Cable's Logo Channel.
Hey, it's me. Leave a message.
Hello. I'm ringing about the advert in this week's Village Voice. I know it's a dreadful time, but if you could give me a ring, I'd be quite grateful. I'm at the St. Regis Hotel.
Hello there, this is Connor. I'm interested in checking out the apartment share you listed online. You know, I already live below 14th Street, so it's not a problem for me to get there at all. It could be great to see it this afternoon. Now
hey, calling about the apartment thing. This might be bad timing and all, but I need to find a place soon, as my girlfriend's giving me the boot. So I wanted to... That's her on the other line. All right. You got my number now, so let me know when you're showing it. Okay, later.
In the wake of 9/11-themed movies, like Paul Greengrass's Real Time, United 93, and Oliver Stone's heavy-handed World Trade Center, writer-director Brian Sloan's WTC View is a refreshing, stripped-down take on the after-effects of the tragedy without the special effects. Based on his astonishing play, Brian's film is about a young gay man who places an ad on September 10th looking for a new roommate to share his two-bedroom apartment. Not only is it in Soho, it has a great view of the Twin Towers.
I'm Brian Sloan, filmmaker and writer.
What was the genesis of the film?
Well, it basically was inspired by a very true life situation. On September 10th, right before I went to bed that night, I had put an ad online on the Village Voice website for a roommate. I had been trying to find a roommate for about a month, I guess, and had not really been focused on it. I was just kind of emailing friends and calling people and wasn't really doing a big search. I had a lot of other things going on at the time, and I just wasn't focused on it, so I really... The 15th of September was coming up, so I put this ad out. And then the next day, you know, September 11th, everything happened that happened. My apartment is in the Soho part of New York, so we weren't directly affected, but, you know, it was something that happened basically in my neighborhood. So I left the apartment. I stayed with my boyfriend out in Brooklyn. And a couple days later, I called my answering machine, and it was the strangest mix of these frantic messages of my friends wondering where I was, mixed in with people saying, oh, hi, I'd like to come see your apartment on September 12th. And that, to me, just was extraordinary. I didn't know what to make of it, even. I just knew it was very bizarre and unusual. So 6 to 8 months later, I just started thinking about those messages and that whole situation of me trying to find the roommate, and I thought it could be an interesting way in to explore what happened on 9/11 for the people who lived in Manhattan, not necessarily the people, the many victims who died, which is, I think, the story most people know. And this, you know, is meant to be the story people don't know.
Talk about the transition from stage to screen.
Well, I started writing it as a play, really, because I thought there was no way this could ever be a movie. The way I sort of envisioned it was very much these people coming to see this apartment, different people coming in to visit, and basically telling their stories and having this conversation about what was going on in the world and how that was affecting everyone's lives. And I started writing it as a play because I couldn't see it as anything but a play. And then when we did the play, we got some really great notices, but we had trouble finding anyone commercially in the theater world who wanted to transfer it because there had been two big 9/11 themed plays previous to this one, and they'd been huge flops. And the feeling in the New York commercial world was nobody wanted to see a play about 9/11. So then we started, you know, exploring it as a film, and fortunately found some investors to make it happen.
In WTC View, we are introduced to Eric's best friend, Josie, whose husband has lost interest in her since 9/11. We learn of Eric's earlier breakup with his boyfriend, which threw him off balance even before the horrific events outside the window. And we meet the prospective roomies he interviews.
So, you don't have an apartment right now?
My place was down in Battery Park City.
Oh.
I shouldn't say was. It's still there. They just won't let us in yet. Said all the units are covered in dust. Layer of toxic crap on everything.
Were you there when it happened?
No, thank God. I would have freaked out. I mean, not that I didn't freak out, but I mean, you know, it's two blocks away.
So you'd already left for work?
Nah, I was in Jersey City Monday night to meet this chick for a date.
Oh.
Are you gay?
Yeah, but I...
The ad didn't come out. Say it. I can read between the lines. Clean, quiet, responsible, seeks male, gay.
Well, gay is charged.
5 years after 9/11, there have been five or six plays and a handful of movies dealing with the tragedy. But Brian Sloan believes that WTC View is a bit different.
Most of them tend to go at 9/11 in a very direct way and tend to tell people things they already know, and they tend to be, you know, a little melodramatic. And I think that is off-putting, I think, to audiences, to a modern audience, especially given the fact that everyone is so familiar with these events. And the thing that I think made WTC View unique was that it really takes a more sideways approach. It's really about this guy trying to find a roommate in a very strange time. The 9/11 aspect of it is certainly there and is certainly a big part of the show, but the show has a dramatic focus, which is not 9/11. It's about him and his apartment and his relationship with his boyfriend as well, and how that's being affected by all this stuff.
What would you like people to take away from your film?
The events of 9/11 were so massive, I think sometimes it's hard for people to even get a grasp of what happened. The thing I was going for, I guess, in WTC View was to really show on a very personal and intimate level one person's struggle with all this, and how even the death of one person can really throw people's lives asunder. And I think when you look at the play in that context and then think, well, this happened to 3,000 other people, basically, then I think hopefully you can sort of understand really the immenseness of that event. I think it's still something people don't quite get in a way. And part of that's because of all the things that have happened since then have sort of politicized the events of 9/11. And I want the play to sort of show, in the movie, to show to people that, you know, this was an immense tragedy, first and foremost. And I think that's something that's kind of gotten lost in the rush of Afghanistan and Iraq and now these other bombings in other cities and countries around the world. But this is really a pretty immense event, and I think it's still something people are coming to terms with.
This has been a conversation with Brian Sloan, writer-director of I Think I Do and now WTC View. Brian's also the author of the hilarious novels A Really Fine Prom Mess and Tale of Two Summers. More info can be found at briansloan.com and, as always, at stevepride.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
For choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Charles Hall, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Steve Pride contributed program material. You heard music from the WTC View soundtrack by Todd Almond and Billy Olitzhauser, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. Click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners, and we thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special LGBT movie, music, and history CD thank you gifts. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 383. 327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WHYS, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, 2HOT, Cobar, New South Wales, KUGS, Bellingham, Washington, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're all going to stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
And welcome back. My name is Elisar Saliba, and one of the points I didn't get to with Joe Tarver was the fact that 9/11, September 11th, as tragic as it was, did provide the GLBT community with a very powerful legal weapon. During the events, our families were considered as other families, biological or not, and this gave us precedent. This gave us a chance to show that we are Americans too. We are not second-class Americans, and because of this, we were able to build upon it with small bits of legislation on the county and county, city, and state level. And these small victories allow us to build towards larger victories, and that's why this sort of thing is so important.
Thank you, Ellie. Well, announcement. There will be no queer bingo this Saturday.
Well, I was going to do that. You stole my thunder.
You can repeat it again.
Okay.
But I promised Nancy Ford that I would announce that this Sunday, the 17th, the 12th annual Houston Women's Festival kickoff will be with a day-long concert featuring music, food, food hot off the grill even, and a silent auction with desirable goodies.
Are you going?
Oh, I would imagine might make an appearance. There will also be representatives from the Houston Equal Rights Alliance on hand to register voters, so if you're not registered,
that's right.
You can take care of that. It's this Sunday from 3 to 10 p.m. at Chances at 1100 Westheimer. For more information, call 713-523-7217. Our friend Nancy Ford will MC, and there's a whole lineup of performers. The Houston Women's Festival is set for Saturday, October 21st, starting at 12 noon at Jones Plaza downtown. And for more information, you can go to www.hwfest.org or myspace.com/HoustonWomen'sFest.
Excellent.
And there will be no queer bingo.
That's right. You got to give me the cue. Give me the sign. Yes, there will be no queer bingo this weekend. There's the possibility of queer bingo on the 21st of October.
Now, we want to remind you about The Normal Heart, being directed by Joe Watts at Theater New West. It's Larry Kramer's breakthrough production about the AIDS crisis. It's at Baring and James Gallery, 805 Road Place, number 500, just off of Taft in West Dallas. And you can call for reservations, 713-522-2004. It will be playing through the 30th of September.
And we want to thank our guests tonight, Joe Tarver with Empire Pride, Tim Brookover with the Houston GLBT Community Center, and there will be no queer bingo this weekend. Joan Devlin and her interview with Steve Rawls of the Service Members International, the This Way Out crew at KPFA in Los Angeles, and in memory of those that we lost on September 11th, 2001, and the ones we are losing now due to the foolishness of a war that should never have happened.
Stay tuned for World Village Cafe with Matthew Momo and crew, and join us next week on Queer Voices starting at 8 p.m. right after Larry Payne and Interchange, when our guests will be Sol Laura and Elizabeth McLean discussing Sisters and the upcoming Decadent Dessert fundraiser. We'll also have the Wyatt Rant with pundit Carol Wyatt, chair of the board of Pride Houston and the moderator of WWW Social Notes Houston HoustonHouston.com.
Jeff Reed with the Houston Equal Rights Alliance reporting on political matters of concern, and Joey Guerrero, the new editor of the Houston Voice, along with Ed Alvarez, will be here to talk about the launch of the Voice as a monthly publication and expanded website.
Been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Polinski. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Weeknights at 7 p.m., KPFT brings you a powerful mix of news, music, talk, and community. Tune in.
On Mondays at 7, Larry Payne discusses education, housing, and health care on Interchange.
Tuesday nights at 7, kick off our night of bilingual Latino programming.
KPFT highlights the arts, politics, and culture from Houston and throughout Latin America.
On Wednesdays at 7, tune in to Air Voices for perspectives from around the world.
On Thursdays at 7, enjoy the Progressive Forum.
From local happenings to international viewpoints, Wally James and company bring you the best of our peace and justice community.
And Fridays at 7 feature Dean Becker's Cultural Baggage.
Listen in as Dean takes the decision makers and public to task every week on the drug war and the lives affected by it.
Hear these shows weeknights at 7 p.m.
This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
KPFT, Houston.
Let's jam in the international style on Music Beyond Borders every Tuesday and Thursday from 2 to 3 p.m. KPFT Houston, Texas, 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.